Good afternoon, everyone. It's Monday, February 14th, Valentine's Day, at NYU Law School, beginning the series that we're going to be doing on economics and social justice in Jewish law. And today will serve as, you know, both the first topic about free market, but also an introduction to how I personally got into this whole thing, including a little bit of a word on methodologies. So first again, thanks to David Parachoki for bringing me in again. So first I want to discuss like how I got into this topic, in particular what my approach is going to be to this. In my experience in the Jewish world, when people talk about social justice, I found that there's a decidedly what we consider a politically left-wing liberal bent to social justice, meaning here's how social justice is defined, and it's usually going to be one of a couple of key issues, some of which we'll discuss, like labor laws and the like. And what I found is people will say, cite bits and pieces of, you know, Jewish sources. They may even cite a source completely accurately in context, but will frequently ignore contradictory data that would be in opposition to their prime objective that they want to stress. And we'll talk. I'll give some examples about that with a couple of the later classes. And what I'd like to try to show here is that there is an idea of a social ethic within the economics and social justice system within Judaism. It's just not one that can be simply defined by the modern-day political constructs. In our political atmosphere, somewhat oversimplifying this, you've got left and you've got right. You've got people who are very big into government intervention, and you've got, you know, free market people, or you can say capitalism versus socialism, or use more incendiary language depending on, you know, what you view your opposition as. And when people try imposing that on Judaism, it doesn't really work. Judaism isn't capitalism. Judaism isn't socialism. It has elements that you'll find in both areas. And to simply reduce it to one or the other is, I think, dishonest. And instead of trying to say, well, here's one source and here's a contradictory source, what I'm going to try to show is that the two sources that might seem to be what we would take of opposing political viewpoints actually form and really inform what the Jewish approach is to social justice. And we'll develop this over seven different lectures. So today we'll be talking about free market. Next week we'll be talking about market intervention. So know right off the bat that these are cherry-picked sources. And all we're going to discuss today is where you have within Jewish sources a free market ethic. Not to say it's to the exclusion of everything else. For example, charity is something that comes to mind, and we'll actually discuss charity, you know, a couple of other weeks. But it's, you can't just say it's either one or the other. It's really a mixture of both. And I would say the true just society, or at least the Jewish vision of a just society, is one that takes into account two legitimate sides of the equation. Another point of methodology that I'd like to mention is when talking about Jewish sources, just as people can cite from, say, one text selectively, people can also arbitrarily choose which sources they're going to follow. To give one example, there's a female conservative rabbi who wrote for the Huffington Post recently about a labor issue in Israel, and was saying that, you know, the way that I believe it was the school that was run by conservative Judaism, Machon Shefter, was having a labor dispute, and she was writing that the conservative movement's positions on dealing with the laborers was going against Jewish law. And two of the people she happened to cite were Rav Avadia Yosef and Rabbi Moses Feinstein, or Moshe Feinstein. Now, to hear a female conservative rabbi quote Rav Avadia Yosef and Rav Moshe Feinstein is incredibly strange, considering what Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Avadia Yosef thought about conservative Judaism. They were really not big fans of it in the least. And if anyone's interested, we'll be talking about that in my show in a couple of weeks. But, yeah, plug for some other time. The point being to say, well, we're going to rely on Rav Moshe Feinstein here because he said something we like, and we're going to ignore everything else that he says about Jewish law, seems to be a little bit strange in my opinion. So in terms of sources, to avoid issues of why you're quoting one person as opposed to another, most of the sources I'll be citing here are from Gemara, particularly particularly the Babylonian Talmud or Tanakh. These are sources that are universally canonical to Judaism, and it's much harder to dismiss the authenticity of, or the legitimacy of, why are you quoting the Bible? Why are you quoting the Talmud? It's a little bit easier, why are you quoting Rambam? We don't care about Rambam because other people argued with Rambam. What I'm trying to say that these ideas appear within Judaism, and I'm backing that up by quotes in Tanakh or Talmud, you know, you'll at least know where I'm coming from. These are things where no student of Judaism is going to say, this is not an authentic or a canonical Jewish source. All right? So, you can go around, start off with what are the basics of the free market? All right, would anyone actually like to give their own definitions or some ideas about free market stuff? And we have a few law students here. I figured someone would have something on it.
With a lack of regulation.
Okay, lack of regulation, which would entail also?
Like people doing, everyone working in their own self-interests and those forces coming together to produce.
Great way of putting it. You know, people are operating within their own self-interests. Can you take source number one to sort of give us some, you know, background to it? First source is from Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. Yes, I know there's a lot more to capitalism than Adam Smith, but I figured, again, no one's going to argue too much about why you're quoting Adam Smith, Wealth of Nations, in a class on free market. So go ahead.
Every individual necessarily labors to render the annual revenue of the society as great as he can. He generally, indeed, neither intends to promote the public interest, nor knows how much he is promoting it. He intends only in his own gain, and he is, in this, as in many other cases, led by an invisible hand to promote an end which is no part of his intention. By pursuing his own interest, he frequently promotes that of the society more effectually than when he really intends to promote it. I have never known much good done by those who affected to trade for the public good. It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect their dinner, but from their regard to their self-love. I never talk to them of their own necessities, but of their advantages.
Right, so this really encapsulates, you know, motivation. Greed is good, right, because our economy works by people acting in their own self-interest, based on their own needs and their own desires. Which on one end you think it's like, wow, this is overly selfish. You know, for Judaism can't possibly in any way justify someone acting their own self-interests. Maybe, maybe not. David, take this is a Gemara in Yoma on 69b.
Sure. They, the members of the Great Assembly, said, since this is a time of divine favor, let us also pray that the evil inclinations for immorality will also be subdued. They requested this of God, and the inclination, was delivered to them. The evil inclination said to them, see if you kill him, i.e. me, you will destroy the entire world. They imprisoned it for 3 days, and they sought a freshly laid egg in all of Israel, and they could not find one.
So one of the prohibitions that you have in Judaism is on arayot, or on, you know, certain sins of sexual immorality. And they said, well, you know what, maybe we should, you know, since God, part of a larger context of men of the Great Assembly praying to God, you know, we should take away from us this evil inclination. And they prayed, and the evil inclination said, go ahead and you'll destroy the entire world. And what they found at the end was, without the evil inclination, you had no productivity. Or at least in this case here, they sought a freshly laid egg and they couldn't find one, meaning even the chickens stopped procreating. In a more abstract sense, the context is, if you take away people's desire, or at least for self-motivation, or to benefit, or, you know, as we would say, what we would otherwise call greed, people would just stop doing things. You have a bunch of law students here. Why are you all in law school, right? Probably because, you know, I'm assuming, you know, someone's not forcing you to be here. It's you think it's in your self-interest, right? You know, why do people teach it? You're trying to better yourself. You're trying to better your situation. If you didn't, right, and you never really tried to do anything more, you'd never push yourself intellectually. You'd never push yourself professionally. And you'd basically be stuck in a rut. And, you know, you'd never actually develop anything that needs to be developed. And from this Gemara, there seems to be at least some understanding whether or not it's, it's weird that you've got the, it's associated with the evil inclination, but there's also a sense that the evil inclination is what can be channeled for good. And it is what channels us, and it is what propels us to really be productive members of society and to really create things and move things forward. So whether or not it's a, quote, good thing or a bad thing, there is a sense that it's necessary for the world to evolve. Could you please take source number three? verses in Devarim 11, 13 to 17. Also, please, if anyone has any questions, feel free to chime in with stuff. Go ahead.
So if you faithfully obey the commands, and you beloved the Lord your God, and serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, and send rain on your land, autumn and spring rain, that you may gather in your grain, your wine, and oil. I'll provide grass and a field for your cattle, careful, or you will be enticed to turn away from God and bow down to them. Then the Lord's anger will burn against you in the rain, and the ground will yield no produce. And you will soon perish from the good land of the Lord.
All right, does anyone, if anyone follows along in the Hebrew, does anyone know where this is from? Yeah, Shema. It's the second paragraph of Shema. If you can sum up, you know, at least this passage of the Shema in a couple of words, how would you define this?
Be good and you'll get good things.
Yeah.
Be bad, no bad.
You'll get bad things, right? We would call this, you know, from a religious perspective, reward and punishment. From a market perspective, it kind of works the same way. If you do positive things, you will be rewarded, or at least, you know, things that have a positive capitalistic end. If you don't do it, or on the contrary, you're a bad business person, you are going to be faced with the losses. In a sense, this is kind of how, you know, and it seems like an odd parallel to make, but in some ways I do think it works. That just as in the free market, you know, positive actions are rewarded, negative actions are generally penalized, unless, of course, you get government bailouts. You know, your relationship with God is kind of works the same way with reward and punishment. Do what you're supposed to do, you'll have something good. Do something you're not supposed to do, you're going, you know, you'll have negative consequences. Again, part of this is, even if you want to not apply this, you know, to the you don't think it's an exact parallel, I think there's an understanding of human nature. And in fact, Maimonides, in his introduction to Shmona Prakim, in his introduction to Perek Chelek, where he describes, he actually lays out the full text of what became known as the 13 Principles of Faith, one of the analogies he gives to why do we have like this reward system of you know, even the world to come, and he said it's actually kind of like how we teach kids. You know, it's like you do something good, you get rewarded. This is basic incentive and disincentivism that you find in the free market. It's one of the really foundations of, you know, free market really progressing. Right? Yeah.
Well, it seems like it could be the opposite. It's basically saying, you know, do what I tell you, and then I'll give you all the good things you want.
Yeah.
Versus the free market, which is, you know, go out and get it yourself, otherwise you're not going to get it.
In a sense, yes. I mean, I would probably make an exception with, say, God doing it, meaning is God the ultimate regulator? But he's appealing to our sense of of self-interest, of you want to have good things, do what you're supposed to, and this is what you're going to get. It's kind of how you know, doing the commandments, or, you know, with the positive and the negative ones, are, you know, being portrayed. You know, you're trying to incentivize certain behaviors and disincentivize others. That's free market stuff, or at least whether or not you are endorsing it, there's certainly that understanding that this is how people work, and enough that God's at least playing into it. Yes, you've got other rabbinic sources that say, you know, don't do this like a worker who's expecting a reward. Do it like, you know, do all these commandments not, you know, such that you're not expecting a reward. That doesn't, you know, just because you have a later rabbinic statement that says, well, that might not be the way you ought to approach the religion, it certainly was the way people were doing it enough that this is how God presented things, you know, and as clear, you know, clearly as possible. All right? Another issue that's very big with the underlying the free market of incentivizing certain activities and disincentivizing others is a fundamental principle of choice. Like my own personal political leanings are towards libertarianism, you know, socially liberal, fiscally conservative, government out of people's lives. It's a tendency, it's not, you know, hard fast rule. And a lot of that is based off of give people, assuming, you know, they don't infringe on other people's rights, give people the ability to make their own decisions, determine for themselves, you know, maybe what would be the best course of action without someone else saying, I think this is better for you to do, and therefore I'm going to tell you to do it. Yes, things are different when God is telling you what to do, but we'll see that this issue of choice is a crucial part of Judaism. Please take verse number 4. Devarim 30:19.
This day I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you, life and death, blessings and curses. Now choose life so that you and your children may live.
One of the most fundamental principles you have in Judaism is what we call Bechira Chofshit, freedom of choice. Yes, God is telling you, I want you to do something, or I don't want you to do other actions, but there's a fundamental acknowledgement that you do have the choice of going which way you want to do. It's for those who are interested in talking about theology, afterwards we can get into how does free will play against divine providence. We'll table that question aside, but again, within the Bible itself, we see that there is choices given. We are supposed to choose a certain way, but that in no way takes away your choice. Whereas in other forms of government that you might be able to parallel today, it's we don't want you to make the decisions, but rather we're going to make these decisions on your behalf. Now keep in mind that in the Torah system, it's not that you should have. Yes, you are given choice, but to stress just how clearly it is, you have statements of v'hazita tov ha'yashar b'inei Hashem. You are supposed to do what is good and what is right in the eyes of God, as opposed to ish ha'yashar b'inav ya'aseh. Everyone does what is right in their own eyes. There does seem to be here of the Torah does not believe in, say, a completely subjective, individualistic sense of morality. Like there are laws of things that you should be doing and should not be doing. For anyone who wants to see examples in Jewish history where it didn't go so well, when ish ha'yashar b'inav ya'aseh, people just did what they want. I refer you to towards the end of the book of Judges, the book of Shoftim and the prophets, where among other such stories, you have gang rape and dismembering of a woman and mailing her dismembered corpse all over the nation. Not one of our finest moments. And notably, it is written by their ish ha'yashar b'inav ya'aseh, people did what was right in their own eyes. There is, again, though, a difference between, what the Torah might say is good versus bad, for lack of a better term here, and taking away the fundamental notion that people do have choice and people will operate under a certain set of assumptions, to make whatever decisions that they have. If you take source number 5, this is Gemara in Bava Metzia 51a.
Rav Aman said, I was told on Samuel's authority, if one says to his neighbor, I agree to this sale on condition that you have no claim of overreaching against me, then he can prefer no claim of overreaching against them. But if he stipulates on condition that there is no overreaching therein, then in case of deceit, the charge of imposition can be preferred.
Mm-hmm.
Objection is raised. If one trades on trust, or if one says to his neighbor, this sale is on condition that you have no claim of overreaching against me, then he has no claim of overreaching against him. Now, according to Rav, who maintained, my ruling agrees even with Rabbi Yehuda, who is the authority for this? Said Abaye, it is clear, therefore, that Rav's ruling agrees with Rav Meir only and Shmuel's with Rabbi Yehuda. Rav said, there is no difficulty. One refers to a general condition, the other to a particular stipulation. As it has been taught, when is this said? Of a general condition. But if one explicitly states he's overcharging, for example, if the vendor said to the vendee, I know that this article, which I sell you for 200 zuz, is only worth 100, but I sell it to you on condition that you have no claim of overreaching against me, then he has no claim of overreaching. Likewise, if the purchaser said to the seller, I know that this article, which I buy from you for 100, is worth 200, I do so on condition that you have no claim of overreaching against me, then he has no claim of overreaching against him.
To explain first what this overreaching is, and we'll talk about this next week, it's a certain control that we have, a market control that we have in Judaism. We don't so much have price controls as much as profit controls. There's a law of onaah that you are not allowed to overcharge by a certain amount. And we'll discuss this a little bit more next week when we do get into market interventionism, which would seem to contradict the whole notion of a free market. The whole point of a free market is I am selling certain wares, I set a price, you decide, this price is, the object that you're selling to me is worth the price that you're asking. I willingly give you money, you give me the object, transaction is concluded. If I do not feel that the price that you're asking appropriate amount, I think that you're asking too much, I have that choice not to buy, or you have the choice as the vendor to lower your price, right? And there's this whole negotiation thing, and when you do it on a broader scale, the market kind of corrects itself, where you can compare price in one place, another place, and you can kind of have a certain sort of range. So setting aside on one moment the details of the laws of Ona'ab, which is considered to be a market protection against gouging, even with this condition in place, there is an exception of a freedom of choice. Meaning, if you are very transparent, here is what the object that I'm selling, here is how much I'm paying for it. You can say, I'm willing to buy this, we're willing to have this transaction, only if we both agree that there is no, that you can, how to put this, you can agree to suspend the market protection on the consumer, would be a nice technical way of putting it. This concept of ona'ah, this law of ona'ah, is put in to protect consumers against price gouging, and you as a consumer are allowed to suspend that. You are allowed to overpay for an item, and the seller can say, well, look, you know, I don't want to, yes, I know I'm selling, you know, this item for a lot of money, I don't want you to take me to court later and to say that I overcharge you for it, so I will sell it to you for this price, but only if you agree to waive, you know, this to waive this protection, which is itself kind of fascinating, because you would think that, you know, you don't have a right to waive your protections, but halakha says, or at least in one particular case, you can.
So why would anyone waive their protections?
All right, well, let's think about that for a second. Why would anyone want to waive a market protection?
Because otherwise the seller won't make the sale. If they can't make a certain profit margin, they'll just choose to hold
it. So what's it to you that you don't get overcharged? Isn't that better for you not to be overcharged? Why would you want to be overcharged?
Because it's that item, maybe its inherent value is half of what the person's charging me, but its projected value to me is worth the full amount that they're charging.
Exactly. Supply and demand. Right? We don't care why the demand is there. All you need to know is that the demand is there. My father has a story that he likes, you know, telling about this, where he was riding along on the highway once and he got a flat. And, you know, they called in AAA to replace the tire. He asked him, how much does the tire cost? And, you know, he gave him some astronomical quote. My father said, this is highway robbery. At which point the person said, well, this is the highway. The point being, you know, you're trying with, you're in a situation like that, like, yes, a tire, I don't own a car, so I'm just making up a number here. Let's say a tire costs $50. But if you have a flat and you're in the middle of Montana, you're going to pay $200 for a tire to get out of there and to get home. No offense to people from Montana. Mm-hmm. But you see the point that, as you, I think, said beautifully, value can be subjective, often depending on your needs. We'll talk a little bit next week about, you know, certain forms of gouging and, you know, where the market got in there. But to at least understand the psychology of why would you overpay for something, it could very well be that for whatever reason, you personally need it and you need it right now. Like, why would anyone go to a bookstore today when Amazon, you can get pretty much any book for cheaper, and it's usually you need it right now. Right? And you need it, you know, and you don't want to mess with shipping. Walk-in, yes, you're going to pay a lot more than you should, or at least not that you should, but you're paying a lot more than you could, but say the convenience factor of having it now. So are you treating also the object purely as its value as a commodity? Or are you saying, well, what other associated, I apologize if I'm messing up any economic terms, there could be some attached values to it more than just what the actual commodity is, either sentimental value, either the convenience factor, any other feature that goes along with it that might, you know, pump up the value of this item, right? And, or let's say even social status. And you think, look at, say, luxury items. The luxury, a lot of differences between many luxury items and popular items as packaging. Not necessarily of sufficient higher quality to warrant that markup, but say by wearing, you know, fancier brands, you know, you'll have other, you know, tertiary benefits from it.
But if there wasn't that exception, I mean, then the vendor would have to charge a fair price, you know, based on this, what this says.
No sale.
No sale. I mean, you have he can decide not, you, the seller doesn't have to sell his wares.
Right, but I mean, wouldn't there be like some negotiation between buyer and seller to reach a price?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
That still would be cheaper than the...
Possibly, but the seller doesn't necessarily have to negotiate. If I have an item that I don't want to part with for whatever reason, then say, well, here's how much money I'm willing to sell, even if it's above market value, because, you know, again, trying to equate the supply and the demand, I'm owning this, so it's going to cost me more to part with it for whatever reason that you have. The point of citing the source from Bava Metzia 51a is simply to show that even a market protection can be waived based on a mutual agreement by the two parties. And if,
but in like in the tire example, you're not really, I mean, the customer is not really waiving the protection. It's kind of being forced. He doesn't really have a choice, because if the seller wouldn't sell it unless he waives his rights, then it's not with protection at all.
So we'll get to certain forms of that like next week. I, you know, gave that as an example in terms of like certain supply and demand needs, and in terms of when you could have again, next, this
he's
is just
forcing the customer to waive his rights, so then it's not
it,
rights.
In a sense, it can be done. We'll see more examples next week of where market controls were installed to prevent that. But on an individual person-by-person, an individual transaction, or even let's even take that take the example of it. Let's say the person isn't even a professional seller. He's not a professional merchant, right? You go into someone's house, you like a painting they have, right? So even though that painting out in the street might cost a lot less, right? So even if you take it out of there, you're still, even though halakhically, you know, you wouldn't be allowed to oversell anything, but here's a situation where you say, well, here's how much it's going to take for me to sell it. Now, the fact that you have a subjective need for it, subjective needs can also change. Like the fact that you absolutely have to have this painting, we're going to say, well, your need there isn't going to be as much as being stranded out someplace. And we'll talk a little bit next week about, you know, where certain areas, you know, the sages did, you know, clamp down because of an overall communal, there was a, sort of an objective need toward it and to prevent real manipulation. You know, again, I cherry-pick these sources intentionally. This week we're focusing on free market, not to the exclusion of the controls, because they're there. I mean, Ona'a itself is a market control. It's, you know, you can't overcharge, right? It's just the fact that you can waive it is, in my opinion, fairly significant. David, take this is a Mishnah from Bava Batra 5.1.
Sorry, go ahead.
Are you disagreeing?
Oh, I'm sorry. I skipped Daniel. I'm sorry, Daniel. Sorry about that.
Keep and sell the ship, sell its mast, sail, anchor, and all the implements needed for directing it. He does not sell the crew, nor the packing bags, nor the stores. If, however, he said to him, it and all that it contains, then all these are included in the sale. He who sold the wagon has not sold the mules. He who sold the mules has not sold the wagon. He who sold the yoke has not sold the oxen. He who sold the oxen has not sold the yoke. Rabbi Huda said, the price indicates what is to be included in the sale. How? If he said unto him, sell me your yoke for 200 zoos, it is obvious that a yoke alone is not sold for 200 zoos. But the sages say the price is not food.
All right, give people a second to, you know, read through this carefully. Feel free to compare with the Hebrew too. You're talking about a, you know, certain types of, you know, selling back. I mean, today when you buy a car, you buy something with a lot of different features, you usually have like a checklist of every detail that's included, you know, all the features. Back then, it wasn't always so clear. And you might have said, well, you know, when I bought this, I assumed X, Y, and Z would go along with it. It's something that Americans who moved to Israel have a really tough time, you know, trying to grasp. For example, I know of a case where someone had a house built, and they built the house, but they didn't build steps going up to the front door. And you say, how do you have a house without steps going up to the front door? How am I supposed to get in? It's like, oh, that costs extra. You know, and it's like, well, you know, from an American person, like, you assume this is what you get. In Israel, apparently not. So here you have a discussion of, if you sell a ship, are there things that implicitly, what implicitly goes along with the sale, and what is not implicit? And in the last case here, you know, in the last part of the second part of the Mishnah, you have, if you're selling the wagon, does it mean that the mules go along with it? Or if you sell the yoke, it doesn't necessarily mean you sell the oxen along with it. Rabbi Yehuda was of the opinion that it is indicative. For example, if I'm selling you, I'm trying to think of a good example. If I'm selling you a car, and there's some attachment to it, and I'm charging, you know, some exorbitant price for this car, you might say, well, if the car alone isn't worth it, it must include the attachment. So, like, if I'm saying 200 zuz was approximately how much it would, I went on the poverty line, and it was also about how much people made in a year. So it was a lot of money. You know, in the time of the mission, at least, that they're referring to, saying, well, you know, if you're saying, you know, if you're trying to sell a yoke for 200 zuz, right, that's a lot of money, you know, for those days. So to say, well, no one would sell a yoke for that much money. So therefore, if you're charging that much, then of course you can assume that the oxen are going to go along with it. Otherwise, it's not going to be a fair sale. Let me try to give a good example here. Like, let's say you've got, you know, an old Datsun car with a trailer hooked up next to it, and you're charging, say, 30 grand for this Datsun. You might say, well, clearly it must include the trailer because, you know, Datsuns are not worth that much money. Anyone here, no one here remembers Datsun. Does anyone know what Datsun, they eventually became Nissan way back when. See, wow. Just dating myself here. Anyway, point is, you know, some like junky car or whatnot. Now, the answer of the sages is fascinating in its own right, where they say the price isn't a proof. Why isn't the price a proof? Meaning that the fact that you're charged over, let's say you're charging an exorbitant amount for the yoke, why is that not, why do you not assume that the oxen go along with it?
I mean, explain, they could have waived the right that we just read about.
Okay. And more to the point,
they can buy it for whatever price they want.
Exactly. At the end of the day, the fact that he's charging a certain amount of money, right, even if he's overcharging for it, doesn't mean that it goes along with it. It's, you have every right as a consumer to overpay for stuff. That's your right. That's exactly what free market is. You determine as a consumer how much you're willing to pay. And if you're willing to pay 200 zuz for a yoke, yes, people can think you're an idiot, just as, you know, you could think people who are, you know, either driving certain cars spent their money unwisely, people who buy all sorts of things spend their money unwisely. It's your free will as a consumer to do that. Yeah.
And also, like, just because you might then, so the person overcharging, you've never waived your right, then you do have a claim. You can go to a bacon and say this person overcharging, but it doesn't mean you have a claim to actually take the oxen, because it couldn't have just been the oak.
Also true.
And it's also the oxen.
Ah, spoken like a true lawyer. Meaning if you're going to take him to court over something, you have to have like the right, if he did something inappropriately, you have to find the right statute that he violated. It's not maybe he misrepresented himself, he just violated the overcharging part. You want to yell at him for overcharging, that's one issue, right? But that doesn't necessarily, you can't just assume that everything else goes along with it. Your sale is your sale. You offer a certain amount of money, you get a certain good back in return. All right? So here we're going to get back a little bit into supply and demand, certain price fluctuations. David, this is Gemara and Tanit 19 A and B.
Okay. What is the nature of the plague of drought? Rab Yehuda said in the name of Rab, a plague which leads to scarcity. Rabbi Nachman said, when grain has to be transported by river from one city to another, it is drought. But when it has to be brought overland from one province to another, it is famine. Rabbi Hanina said, if a seah of grain costs one seah and is obtainable, it is drought. But if four seahs cost a seah but are not easily obtainable, then it is a famine. Rabbi Yochanan said, this holds good only when money is cheap and food dear. But if money is dear and food cheap, then the alarm is sounded at once. For Rabbi Yochanan said, I remember well the time when four seahs cost one seah, and yet there were many in Tiberias swollen from hunger because there was not a coin to be had.
Right. Any thoughts on this? I should add here that whenever I cite something from the Babylonian Talmud, I use the Cincino translation, usually because I can just simply cut and paste it. So if anyone has issues with the translations, take it up with them. Are anyone seeing here, what are people getting, at least from, you know, certainly the second half, the first part, we're trying to trying to distinguish what is the difference between a famine, a drought and a famine, right? According to Rabbi Hanina, how are you defining the difference between a drought and a famine? What are the criteria that he's using? I'll give you a hint. It's the heading in number 3. Anyone? It's written right there. Exactly! It's supply and demand. When you have less food available, it's going to cost more, right? And then you also have, you know, holds good when money is cheap and food is dear. But if money is dear and food cheap, the alarm is sounded at once. For remember, when four seahs cost one seah, and yet there were many in Tiberias swollen from hunger because there wasn't a coin to be had, meant that on one hand, yes, the price of food might have been cheap, but just because the relative food price was cheap doesn't necessarily mean that people were still even able to afford that. There was we'll see, from the few sources now, but as we'll see in the subsequent weeks, the sages had a fairly advanced understanding of economics. And there was an understanding about what does it mean to have money, what does it mean for price fluctuations with food. There's clearly that acceptance that in a time of drought or famine, food is going to be scarce. People need food. Supply is low. Demand, let's say it's not going to be any higher than usual. People say eat the same amount, but when your demand decreases, the demand is the same and your supply decreases, your prices are going to go up. Right? That seems to be somewhat natural. It's not, and we'll talk a little bit next week about you know, again, the market controls about to what extent can you, you know, tolerate some fluctuations here. But there was a certain acknowledgement that this is just simply how the world works. When you have scarcity of a certain resource, it's going to cost more. Right? That's kind of what gives something value. All right? Makes sense so far? All right, could you take source number 8? This section, one of the issues that I want to also bring in here about free market ethics is, in addition, you know, to a freedom of transaction, of, you know, I can sell whatever I want, you can buy whatever you want, is entry into the marketplace. Some of the regulations that have been in place to sort of restrict competition includes things like, say, licensing, which, you know, you're all going to know by, you know, passing the bar, and you all will pass the bar, you know. But that's one way that you can prevent people from just flooding the market with a whole lot of lawyers. You can't just practice law wherever you go. You actually have to pass certain tests. And yes, you can say that there's a quality control aspect to it, but it also helps keep, you know, the employment pool, you know, at a reasonable level here. But part of capitalism, you could say, is, or at least a free market, is anyone can enter any market that they see fit, and the market will decide whether or not they're going to succeed. Meaning, in theory, anyone could, for a free market, anyone can sell goods, services, set whatever price they want to sell, and if the consumer doesn't like what they're selling or doesn't like what they're selling at that price, they will, on their own freedom, decide, hey, I don't want to do any business with you. And eventually, either you adjust what you're doing in terms of changing what you sell, changing your services, improving your services, or lowering your price, or you're going to get out of the business because you're just not going to be able to survive. Right. So in section 4 here, I have a couple of sources that discuss the free free market entry and competition in Judaism, or at least within, again, by Judaism, I mean specifically rabbinic sources. Take source number 8, please. This is a Mishnah Bava Metzia 4:12.
Rabbi Yehuda said, a shopkeeper must not distribute parched corn or nuts to children, because he thereby accustoms them to come to the sages permitted, nor may he reduce the price. But the sages say, is to be remembered for this.
All right, so you have a case here of a dispute between Rabbi Yehuda and the sages. Rabbi Yehuda says shopkeeper can't give stuff for free because they're going to get used to it, and the sages say that's fine, and he can't reduce the price, but the sages say he's fine. Any modern day parallels to something like this in the market? Explain. Yeah. You know, why are you giving discounts to some? Because you're going to kill the business. If I give discounts to one group, right, then I'm going to accustom them to get used to businesses, which is to, you know, spending a certain amount or getting stuff for free. So it's good for me because I might get the return business, but it'll also put, you know, someone else out of business. This comes up a lot with the airline industry, or at least, you know, I know there have been accusations of it where you'd have a small carrier, and when a small carrier becomes a threat to a bigger carrier, the bigger carrier will take greater losses, undercut the smaller carrier on price, just enough to put the smaller carrier out of business, and then they raise their prices, you know, much more afterwards, which you can say you can do in a free market system, and, you know, you'll all know this a lot better than I do about exactly what regulations are in place to prevent that. But it seems here that the sages are allowing the seller, I mean, up until now we spoke about a seller overcharging, the sages seem to be completely fine, or at least in this Mishnah, about undercutting competition. I mean, you're talking about, like, even giving, you can talk about this as either giving promotion stuff that you otherwise wouldn't sell. You can see why there would be an objection to it, because if you get people accustomed to getting free stuff, I mean, you could worry about, like, what does that mean for society as a whole, which would also kind of go against the free market, so we'll get to that in a couple of weeks too, but also what it means for the marketplace, you know, about undercutting competition or getting people used to a certain level of service that might not be sustainable. I mean, even someone that might give a great introductory promotion or discount, you know, as they say, with drugs, the first one is always free, right? You give them free stuff first, you get them hooked, and then once they're hooked, then you tell them how much it really costs. Another source here, number 9 from Bava Batra 21b.
An objection was raised against Rav Kuna's ruling that one cannot interfere with another's livelihood from the following. A man may open a shop next to another man's shop, or a bet next to another man's bet, and the latter cannot object. Because you can say to him, I do what I like in my property, and you do what you like in yours. On this point, there is a difference of opinion among Tanaim, as appears from the following brisa. The residents of an alley can prevent one another from bringing a tailor, or a tanner, or a teacher, or any other craftsman, but one cannot prevent another from setting up an opposition.
So there is a dispute here in terms of to what extent can you enter, can you restrict someone from opening up a business, right? We have one opinion here that a you know, that basically what you decide to do in your own private property is your own free will. Again, free markets, so sell whatever you want. As far as the dispute goes, there were certain issues that the Gemara explains of a tailor, a tanner, where you can want people to be excluded from the market because you would have other effects. Like a tanner in particular would be working in a profession that has, trying to find a tactful way of putting this, let's say very bad smelling. And you can see why you don't want bad smelling there, because it's no longer an issue of, you know, you yourself earning a living, but now you're also adversely affecting everyone else around you. Gemara will also discuss about teachers. You can have competition with teachers. It says kinat sofri marbe chokhma, that the jealousy of scholars will increase knowledge or increase wisdom. The point being here, at least, you know, without taking a psak perspective on it, is that even just holding that there is a dispute means that there was a sensitivity, regardless of how halacha is ultimately determined, right, of a free market in Judaism, not just in the areas we saw before about commerce, but also of services, and of saying what you do in your own house is completely up to you. And whether or not, you know, you can prevent someone from coming in, or whether or not you can't prevent someone coming in, yes, that's a matter of a dispute, but there's one opinion that says no. You have no right to prevent someone from earning a legitimate wage, I mean, assuming it is legitimate. It's like, if someone wants to do a job, that person's going to go in there and is going to do their job. All right? Where again, we're going to discuss controls here. It's not necessarily an absolute. The whole point of this class was to at least show that there is a sense of free market ethic within Judaism, that such a thing does exist within Jewish sources. Have 9 sources here that I believe, you know, express that in one way or another. Is that exclusively Judaism? Of course not, because Judaism is a lot more than 9 sources. And we're going to see some more next week. And the intent is not so much to say it's one or the other, but to take these two, what we would have sort of been conditioned to think, are diametrically opposite, mutually exclusive ethics, and try to put it together and to see, well, you know, what are the ranges and what is the dynamic between the two, so that at the end of the day, we don't just come up with the same usual partisan yelling at each other, you know, you're capitalist and you're a socialist, or you hate America, whichever one you decide, but rather what might really be a true just society on a more holistic level. So next week we're going to discuss some of the market controls in Judaism. All right? Thank you all very much, and hope to see you next week.
Thank you.
Wait, any questions?